Support comes from Catholic Charities. Driven by the message of love your neighbor, Catholic Charities is focused on improving lives in Maryland. Give the gift of love during this holiday season and learn more at cc-md.org/love.
My first day at work, this white girl from Baltimore handed me a coffee and said, "Hey, we're filming a documentary. Is that okay?"
The English department chair and the board of ed had put me in a situation that I had no business being in.
So when I started college, I started as a chemical engineering major, and I can tell you that me and science had anything but chemistry.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to a special edition of the Stoop Storytelling Series on WYPR. I'm Laura Wexler.
And I'm Jessica Henkin. Today's theme, work, life, no balance. Over the next hour, five local storytellers will share tales about the highs and lows of the working world, from finding your calling to saying, "I quit."
Up first, here's Len sharing a story about becoming a teacher in the Bronx. Take a listen.
So in 1990, I was a senior at NYU. I was an English major with a specialization in writing poetry, so you can imagine my job prospects were few. But during that semester, I also was tutoring New York City public high school students at a program at NYU, and I had this moment of insight that I think a lot of English majors have, which is that I was going to go into teaching, that I was going to be a public school teacher in particular. To me, it was like the perfect mix. On the one hand, I'd be home at 3:30 in the afternoon so I could continue writing with all of the extra energy I would have. And I did actually believe this at the time. And I would have summers off. Little did I know about the psychic damage that occurs during a school year. So I shared this plan with my girlfriend, who was a native New Yorker, and her family members, who looked at me askance. And 2-1, they said, "Just hope they don't assign you to the South Bronx." So I kind of like had this, you know, there were the benefits that, as I saw, for my writing career, but also I was genuinely interested in making a difference. I was reading about people who had gone into public schools and brought the love of reading and writing to students in underserved communities and crowded classrooms that didn't have good reading materials and teachers that were burned out. I said, I got this. So at the time, luckily, New York City was having a teacher shortage and had come up with a license called a long-term sub-license. So the idea behind the long-term sub-license was that for schools that really couldn't fill vacancies, they would sort of have a licensing program where you could teach just by proving that you had enough credits in the subject area you'd be teaching in. I thought this was great. I put in my application, and then I went backpacking for the summer, sure that I was on the right track and had made a great decision. Came back and went to sort of a cattle call at the New York City Board of Ed and was given a folder that said Jane Addams Vocational High School, the Bronx. So still, I was very optimistic and excited. You know, I thought I'd seen Dangerous Minds with Michelle Pfeiffer. And I felt prepared. I felt like my heart was in the right place. So fast forward to 3 days before the school year is to begin, I have an appointment with the department chair of the English department at Jane Addams Vocational High School. The vocations, by the way, were cosmetology, nursing, and business. I get on the subway. I've only been to the Bronx once to go to the Bronx Zoo in the 4 years that I've been in New York. The train comes out of the tunnel and becomes an elevated track in the South Bronx. And I look out the window, and I see rubble. I see entire blocks of rubble or an abandoned building, more rubble, another abandoned building. And I start to have my first real moment of understanding that I'd gotten myself into something that I didn't completely understand. Turned out that the Bronx in the 70s and 80s had burned. That's a story for another time, but essentially landlords, as their property values dropped when the Cross Bronx Expressway was built, started to hire arson squads and would burn their own buildings. And what I was seeing in 1990 was the result of that. And I thought to myself, I was getting off at 160th and Prospect, and I realized I would have to get out of the train with my little imitation leather briefcase that had a folded New York Times and a blank notebook and a pen in it. And I'd have to go down the stairs and walk to the school. I will tell you, later that year, on the way to school, there was a car burning fully one of those lots. But anyway, I found my way there, found the English department chair, and had what turned out was an interview. I wasn't assigned there, so I had to answer some questions, like, what's your teaching philosophy? How do you plan a class? What's your experience? So I felt pretty good about the answers that I sort of swerved and dodged. You know, I did some tutoring. I'm really into this. I love reading. I love writing. There was a long pause at the end of the interview, and the guy looked at me and said, well, you're certainly going to bring some youthful energy. He hired me. Later, it came to me that probably he was hiring me because I was indeed one step just barely above calling the sub pool every day. And then the day came, and I took the train, got off at 160th and Prospect, and walked into the school fully populated with actual students, not imaginary students. And it was shock. They were big. They were confident, and they knew the school better than I did. They felt at home. They knew the other teachers better than I did. So I went to my first class, and that is the image that really was burned into my psyche from that first year, was standing up like this, talking into the void, and just having 27 students in their little bolted down desks from 1941 staring up at me. I'd been told by the other teachers the first day, it's breeze, you just go over the classroom rules and the expectations and what you're going to be teaching, which, by the way, I didn't have a very clear idea of. So I wrote my name on the board, which was weird, and I started talking, and my voice just went out, this thin sort of nervous voice, and they all looked at me like, we are going to eat you alive. Who are you? I made it through that first 5 minutes, made it through the curriculum, and still had 37 minutes to go. The longest 37 minutes of my life. And I had to do that 3 more times that day. The next day, I actually brought in a story. That failed miserably. I read it to them. Not a single student answered a single question. Again, the minutes ticked by interminably. I somehow made it through that first week. And at that point, I really knew that I was in trouble. I had put myself in a situation. The English department chair and the Board of Ed had put me in a situation that I had no business being in. The only good thing that saved me that year was they assigned a mentor to all of the long-term subs. And my mentor was a woman named Gail Kleiner, who's still to this day one of the best teachers I've ever met. She couldn't save me, don't get me wrong. I didn't really teach a good lesson that year, but she would meet with me every year. We were supposed to write on the board an objective and a motivation. For example, to learn what a literary character is. And the motivation was really hard and puzzling, considering the situation, because you identify with the literary character. Anyway, I never really got the hang of that. She tried to turn my ideas into something that could be used. Fast forward to the end of the year, I somehow made it. I tried to be useful. I did a little literary magazine. I did a lesson or two that worked. sort of, with her help. And at the end of the year, I said, Gail, how long did it take before you were planning lessons that really worked on a consistent basis? And she said, 3 to 5 years. But she recommended that I go do a program at the New York City Board, not at the New York City Board of Ed, at Lehman College in the Bronx, the New York City Writing Project. And I spent a month in a desk with other teachers reflecting on what we could do and doing assignments. And that saved me, and that led to a bunch more years teaching and eventually doing some teacher training. But what I remember from that first year, what I take from it, and it was a very, very long and difficult year, probably two things stuck with me. One is that 22-year-old me, for the first time, really saw how institutions in communities do and do not offer opportunities to the communities that they're in. And that despite that, communities thrive around them. And the second lesson I took was that sometimes you just show up, even in the midst of humbling humiliation. And I learned this from my students, and I probably learned more from them than they ever learned from me. Sometimes you just show up and listen and watch and be patient and just stick it out to really see what's happening. Thank you.
Okay, that was Len. What I especially loved about that story was his the optimism in a briefcase.
Yes, a pencil, a notebook. God bless him. Next, Jerry McCarter, also known as Coach G.
As a kid, I always wanted to be a teacher. And all the teacher would be like, don't be a teacher. You're not going to make any money, you're going to be miserable, and you're going to be sad. And I was like, but you don't look sad. They used to say, wait until you walk out of the door. I'm crying. So I went to school to become a teacher. Before then, though, in elementary school, again, I had some amazing, transformative teachers. And they really made me want to go in the classroom and make these same changes. But I had a change in course in middle school. You know, middle school. Things started growing. Attitudes started changing. People started noticing me in different ways. So I became a troublemaker. Can you believe that? I was a troublemaker, and I had this one amazing teacher who saw me making trouble. And she literally snatched me by my collar, back when that was acceptable. snatched me by my collar, and she was like, get over here. And she kind of like read me for filth. She fussed me out, and she said she wasn't going to call my mother because she's going to deal with me. I mean, she really got me good. And I was like, what are you going to do? I was like really scared. And she was like, I'm going to take you to step practice. I was like, what is step? So I go to step practice, and the doors open, and I'm like, oh my God, this is an orchestra. This is a play. I have to be a part of this. It was transformative. And for those in the room who don't know what step is, it's body percussion. So it's stomping, clapping, using your body, spoken word, to create sound. And I could probably teach everyone in this room, but again, another story for another time. But I will give you my information to book me. So I went to step practice, and I was hooked. I was in seventh grade. I was like failing every class, but step is what got me on track. Every time I was about to make trouble or about to not do so well in class, my teachers, my parents, everyone reminded me, don't you want to be in step? So I got it back on course, and I thought, wow, this is an amazing tool that really helps kids do well. Because I'm doing great, my friends are doing great, and it's all because of step. So I went on through high school, was on a step team, graduated high school, went to college, pledged in a sorority, graduated college, and then after I graduated, I get a phone call from a high school in Baltimore City, and they say, hey, You want to be a step coach? I said, hell no. Why would I do that? I don't want to coach high school kids who have funky attitudes. No. I don't want to coach myself, basically. So I thought, I don't want to do this. But I had a conversation with my husband, and he said, isn't this what you want to do? You want to change lives? You want to change Baltimore? That's what this school's about. Just do it. Try it. You never know. Try for 1 year. You never know what's going to happen. And I said, okay, I'll try it. So my first day at work, this white girl from Baltimore handed me a coffee and said, hey, we're filming a documentary. Is that okay? And my response was, I don't drink coffee. And she says, that's okay. Introduce yourself. I'm going to mic you really, really quick. I was like, what the hell is this? So if you ever seen a documentary, that scene when I'm like walking in like, hey, everyone, that was literally my first day. First time coaching, first day. First day. What a day. So thank you. So from there became this transformative documentary that showed 93 minutes of what is in Baltimore. But I lived it. And it was not 93 minutes. It was 10 months, 20 girls ages 13 to 18 driving me nuts. But it looked really good on camera. My mission was to, no matter what, if my grandparents saw this, if my grandchildren saw this, they would know that this is truly who I am. And though I was so committed to sticking to that, I wish that I would have put on a little bit more makeup and dressed nicer and, you know, did my hair. But people who really know me know that's not my thing. So anyway, after doing all this great work for 5.5 years at this school, the pandemic hits. Dun, dun, dun. And I'm like not fulfilled. I'm not happy. I'm teaching. I'm doing all the things that I worked my whole life to do. And I'm like, why do I still feel so empty? But I'm making up steps and I'm not even seeing these girls. And I'm coming up with programming and I'm not even seeing these girls. And then I just started doing check-ins. Hey, how are you? What's going on? And the things that they were going through was nuts. And I'm like, well, what happened? You never experienced this before. And they said, well, before we were in step and now we're just home. So I thought, wow, this is a big thing. So March 2020, my husband got COVID. So you know, March 2020, if someone got COVID, it was like, move out. So my husband got diagnosed with COVID. Literally, the entire neighborhood shunned him, including myself. And it was like, stay away, get away. And it was extremely scary. And one night, we were sitting. He was in the guest bedroom, and I was sitting in the hallway. And he was, like, writing his will. Mind you, he had no COVID symptoms. But he was positive, though. So he's writing his will and like his eulogy. And I'm like, yeah, add that, do this. And then he's like, seriously, if the world ended today, what would you want your legacy to be? And I said, that's a great question, but how can my legacy be step? And he's like, it already is. You've already done it. Just make it bigger and better. Do what you want to do. Make this the Coach G show. And I'm like, but the world is about to end. And he says, so what? It didn't end yet. Write it out. So I write it out. I file for my papers. I get this nonprofit. I start programming in my head. Write it out. And then nothing. Literally nothing. And I thought, what am I doing wrong here? I was conflicted because I was still coaching at the high school. I was still teaching at the high school. And I had to break away to really elevate. So, long story short, I had hosted a program for voters registration. And about 400 people showed up. So things were moving. And then from there, we got grants. We got sponsors. We got eyes. We got to be in a movie on Apple TV, Swagger. We got to be on CBS The Activist. Things had really took off. So now I'm starting this citywide step team where girls from across the city can come together and perform and also get the life skills that they're missing from their home schools. So I resigned from that high school as a step coach. They're still out there doing great. And I resigned as a teacher, scariest I ever did in my life. Because if you don't know, Baltimore City Public Schools benefits the best. I mean, you could literally get like a heart transplant when you're for like $10 copay. So I was like, what am I gonna do if like my liver fails? Like, what am I gonna do? So it was really scary and it was really rewarding. So it is what I'm doing full time. Thankfully, my husband is still working full time, supporting me as he always has, as he always does. He's picking me up. I don't know if he's here, but he's picking me up today. Support. But my best advice is bet on yourself. Being in a global documentary, I thought I had the world. I met every celebrity you could think of. I met Michelle Obama. Michelle Obama. Man, her teeth are amazing. God, her arm, she smells good. Oh, her breath smells good. But anyway, moving on. I thought I had the world in my hands, and I thought this was my plateau. I thought, oh, who does this? No one does this. No one in my family's done this. This is it. But it isn't. I started Coach G Academy March 2020. We're still rolling. I'm so excited that I bet on myself. The girls who have gone through the program are now coaches. The people who have been supportive are volunteers. And it's all because my husband gave me a nudge. And I actually believe that I could do it. And I believe what I tell my girls all the time. It's never too late. Don't give up. I really talk the talk and walk the walk instead of just feeding them what I wanted them to hear and going home miserable.
Yes.
Yes. Clap for that.
That was Jerry McCarter. You can see Coach G and her team at the Baltimore Leadership School for Young Women in the documentary Step.
Great documentary. Check it out. I'm Laura Wexler. You're listening to a special edition of the Stoop Storytelling Series on WYPR. When we're back...
So I read the ad and they're like, they need somebody who can ride a horse. I can ride a horse. They need somebody who can act. I'd never acted, but I played Dungeons and Dragons. It seems close.
Welcome back to a special edition of the Stoop Storytelling Series on WYPR. I am Jessica Hankin.
And I'm Laura Wexler. Today's theme is work, life, no balance.
Let's listen to this story from Jim Meyer about his reign at Medieval Times.
Yeah, I moved back to Baltimore a couple years ago. I was doing comedy full time and my mom took ill, so I had to move back here and I couldn't be on the road. So I was looking for a job and I checked on Craigslist and I saw an ad that said King wanted. And I thought, you know, finally the job I was born for, you know? So it was Medieval Times, I don't know if you know. Yeah, it's like Denny's with jousting. So I read the ad and they're like, they need somebody who can ride a horse. I can ride a horse. They need somebody who can act. I'd never acted, but I played Dungeons and Dragons. It seems close. And they needed somebody who had a regal bearing. And, well, look at me, fierce. So, like, I emailed them my application, and I guess they liked my cover letter, because I was like, I'm applying for the position of king. And I must admit, I think this is a little weird. Like, aren't these usually handled by divine right? Or maybe yanking cutlery from a stone? But my qualifications include I like making proclamations, and I never eat something that somebody else hasn't tasted first. So they're like, we loved your cover letter, come on in. So I interviewed with Randy, the show manager, and the guy who had been king but was leaving the king job. And I was like, why are you leaving king? He's like, well, I got a promotion. It's like, really? He's like, yeah, what's the promotion? Food and beverage manager. So apparently, it goes like this. It's like serf, squire, knight, king, food and beverage manager, marketing. And now I'm stoked because, like, you know, there's no glass ceiling. I can, you know, move up. So I think I nailed it, right? Because, like, in the interview, they read some lines. We talked Dungeons and Dragons. They needed a druid. I like playing druid. It's perfect. But I don't hear anything for 3 months. I start to lose hope, and they finally call me, and I'm like, of course I want the job. But I cut my hair. You still want me? They're like, yeah. What other job are they bummed that you cut your hair? Except for, like, maybe replacement frontman for Winger. But so I go, and I'd actually just taken another job, and I hadn't started as a BMW salesman. So I have to call the BMW dealership and be like, yeah, I got a better offer. And they asked what, and I was like, King of Spain. But and I gotta say, I love the job. It's the best job I've ever quit. But there were high points and there were low points. The high point was definitely 2007. I was the king for the cherry blossom parade in DC, which I don't know if you've ever been like at the staging area of a parade, but it is a freaking freak show. Like, first of all, I'm getting the squires to hide me from the guys dressed as Minutemen, lest they get carried away and do some regicide or something. But the people staging next to us, I still to this day don't know what they were, but they had horses too, so they're unloading. And they had these like red, white, and blue cowboy outfits, and all the women's saddles said Army of Jesus, and the men's stuff said Soldiers of Jesus, and they had 19 matching albino quarter horses. Now, where do you find that, first of all? But how white bread are you when you're like, even my horse cannot have an ounce of pigment? So, like, we get our horses out, we're getting ready, you know, we're kind of just clipping around a little bit, and we start to realize there's nothing holding us back, so I, like, take off at a full gallop down the National Mall, like that. It's like a big field of grass and trees, and the horses are losing their shit because they're, like, mall horses. So they're not used to the lawn. They're, like, used to, like, I don't know, Baby Gap or something, but so I'm, like, at a full gallop down the National Mall, and I've got my crown on, and my sword is flapping, and my cape is flapping, and I look back, and there's, like, 7 knights with their flags unfurled. The best part is I'd, like, charge by, like, stunned tourists and say, I may be a monarch, but I respect your democracy. That was definitely a high point. But believe it or not, there were low points. Like, for instance, when you're standing there in your cape and crown and scepter across the hall from the Orange Julius stand, you start to look back at your resume and think, maybe I made some bad career decisions. So they don't just start you out as king. They, like, work you up to that, right? So I started out and I would work backstage and I would be a wizard and executioner. So, like, I'd sneak out as wizard in this big silvery cape and a $11 Gandalf mask. And I had, like, I would just get struck by lightning and I would make all these sayings and stuff. But it wasn't actually me talking. It was the guy who was the voice of the NFL on tape. So, but, you know, it was fun. So I started to work into the show. And the best was the people backstage. Like, one day I was hanging out with the head knight, like, Steve. Great guy. He's smoking a cigarette. I'm sitting out back. And he's looking at my motorcycle. He's like, you ride a motorcycle? That is so dangerous. I'm like, dude, you got knocked off a horse 7 times today. You got hit in the head with a titanium axe. And my mode of transport is dangerous. All right. But So my first day to be king, I'm like so stoked. And my mom came out, my girlfriend at the time comes out and everything. And you can pay $20 to get knighted. The $20, I'm going to save you the $20. You'd kneel in front of me, I'd take my sword and be like, in the eyes of God, St. Michael and St. James, I nub you a knight of my realm. Now smile for the camera. But I was so nervous, I was knighting my mom and I forgot my lines. I was like, I dub you a knight with the power of Randy, my manager. Oprah Winfrey. So I'm all stoked that my first moment as king, right? And the show starts. It's like totally dark arena, right? And there's smoke in there, and then like the squires go out with torches, and I ride out and I wheel my horse around in a big circle, and I give this just majestic speech about like my brother dying and the battle we've won and all this awesome stuff that I've been wanting to say forever. But there's like some 35-year-old dork in the second row who just starts going, cheesy. I'm like, dude, you're in a castle in the mall. This is the least cheesy part of your next 2 hours, dude. So I'm telling this story. I realize I'm telling the story, but I feel like I should find some sort of message, some sort of meaning. Did I learn something about people? No, not really. Did I learn something about myself? Other than that I like people to blow a trumpet when I enter a room? Not really. But I learned a lot about horses. Anyway, thanks a lot.
That was Jim Meyer. You've been to medieval times, right?
Yes.
You used to like going with your kids, didn't you?
Yes.
Used to go a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. Not a lot. It's very expensive. It's ridiculously expensive. But it's like a fun thing to do that your kids will remember.
Yeah. You know what we did? We went to Dolly Parton's Stampede, which I think is like the Dolly Parton version of medieval times.
Sure. Yep.
Yeah.
That's what that is. That's in fact how she pitched the whole
idea.
Yeah,
that's right. Sticking with jobs that require a uniform, here's Megan Schutt with a story about becoming Captain Quackers.
In 2003, I graduated from college in Florida, and I moved back to Baltimore, which is where I'm from, and I really, really love the city, just, you know, well, most of you probably also do. And I thought, I really, you know, this is like the last sort of, I felt like it was the last summer of my youth. And I really want to just get a job. I don't want to think about it. I don't want to like start a career yet. I just kind of want just, you know, a normal summer job before I really like try to tackle something bigger. So I get this job working for Ride the Ducks in Baltimore. You know, as most of you know, Ride the Ducks are these huge amphibious vehicles that give people tours of the city. And I thought, this is going to be great. I love this city. I can talk to people about how great it is and sort of, you know, just share that with people. So I'm in their kiosk selling tickets, and they say, well, Megan, we need someone to work as Captain Quackers, our duck mascot. And the big sell to me was you would make $20 an hour in this duck outfit, and you got a free breakfast buffet on Sunday at the Brookshire Hotel. And I was like, free bacon? Free bacon? Are you serious? $20 an hour and free bacon? Yes, I will don a duck suit for free bacon. So they give me this suit, right? And it's this giant duck. So his name is Captain Quackers. And not only is he a duck, but the duck suit itself is dressed up like a captain. So like this duck had rank. And I would put on this outfit. And they gave me, so the mascot code sort of is that you're not supposed to talk. So you need a handler because small children actually think you're a giant duck who captains a boat or something. And you're not supposed to talk. So they hand me this girl who's sort of my handler. And her name's Marla, and she's got, like, this really heavy, like, Eeyore energy, you know, like that, nobody notices me. And I'm supposed to be this happy duck, and I've got, like, Eeyore Marla with me. So on Sundays, we would go, like, do this gig, and I'd, like, waddle around in my little Captain Duck suit, and I was like, this is just, like, the best gig ever. So time goes on, the season kind of wears on, and they really slim down sort of their staff because they don't run in the winter. And they said, well, Megan, we have this position open in the office, and you can be our admin assistant. So I took it because I needed a job still. And then very quickly, that turned into their group sales manager. And I really felt like I have a salary. I negotiated a parking pass. I was like, I have a parking pass and a salary and, like, this is just it. I've arrived in like the working world. But there's this like really weird thing I found that when you're doing a good job sometimes at a job, it's like you get penalized because they just keep asking you to do more. It's like, okay, well, you're doing all your tasks, so like here's another task that needs to be done that we're going to give to you. And okay, you're doing that now, so here's another one, and here's another one. And we don't care that you're staying until 7 o'clock every night at Fried the Ducks. But we're just going to give you more to do. So we had this new sales and marketing manager who thought the key to really bumping up our business was to just have Captain Quackers appear all over Baltimore City. So not only am I sort of doing all this like regular office stuff, but I'm like, I'm at the Baltimore Arena, and I am not an athlete. I'm not even going to play. I am chubby, I'm out of shape, and I do not belong running in a duck outfit. And I'm like, why am I at the arena running around in a duck outfit? Like, the feet. Let me just tell you about the costume. Okay. It's very homegrown. It's not professional. It doesn't get cleaned. It stinks. And it's like this giant fur suit. And then there are these, like, huge duck feet that I have to put on. So I can't really walk because they're giant. And then I have this huge head that cuts off my peripheral vision. And this giant bill. And, you know, like, you see, like, a cone. So it cuts off any vision of like anything from my hands to the ground, which is exactly the size of little kids. So they come up, I'm like, oh, what's going on? I don't understand what's going on. So, you know, I'm at the zoo, like telling my handler we should ask people where the duck pond is. I was like, it'd be really funny, you know, like we're like lost duck, which she didn't think was funny. She was like, people don't have to see your face, they see my face, this is humiliating. And the final, like the biggest sort of event in this duck outfit was they had us booked at a middle school, and it was like some Catholic school off 95, like north of the tunnel, called like, I don't know, St. Our Lady of the Sacred Pearl or something. So they're like, okay, take the duck suit, which I carry in a trash bag, and go to this middle school pep rally. So I also went to Catholic school, and I know how middle school pep rallies go, and I'm like, oh, okay, fine. So I show up there with my trash bag, and I'm putting the suit on. And every time I put it on, I was just like, you know what? I didn't go to college for this. I have a degree, and I don't think college is like the be-all, end-all of everything. I don't think you have to go to be like a good person or have a job you like, but I did not work that hard to put on a duck suit. I just got like, every time I put on those stupid fur mittens, I was like, oh, I hate this. So I'm standing around with the other mascots getting ready to sort of go in to the pep rally. And there's Mama Alardo from Mama Alardo's Pizza. And somebody else. And then there was a big Fox who was Fox News Station, locally our Fox here, and Fox Chevrolet shared a mascot. I'm not kidding. They shared this guy. And we are all standing around. And I'm just like, we're all standing in our suits. And I'm thinking to myself, how did these people get here? Did these people go to college? Like, did these people want to be here? Did these people get stuck here like me? I mean, what? But I just didn't feel like I should ask because I didn't want to sound rude. So I say to the fox, no, the fox says to me, hey, can you hear in that thing? And I said, yeah, I can hear, but I really can't see that well. And he said, oh, because I can see, but I can't hear. So maybe we could, like, help each other. So I was like, yeah, that sounds good. Like, we'll have each other's backs. And I saw through, like, the big duck eyes were, like, made of screen. So I was looking at him through my screen. He was looking at me through his fox mouth. And we sort of had this pact that we would have each other's back. So we go into the auditorium. And it's just like, it's basically just the gymnasium, and all the kids are like sitting around like the court lines, you know, like lined up in a square. And in the back, there is the stage set up, and the middle school band is up there. So the principal or the vice principal is talking on the microphone to like the students about something, and very faintly I hear from the back of the stage this one little kid playing, bam, 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 bam. And I kept thinking, dude, that kid is the only kid who gets it. He is the only person who gets how absurd this entire situation is. I'm like really happy that he is 12 and gets it. So we start our like little thing, and they don't give us any direction. They're like, dance around. So I'm like, well, I live with my duck butt. Being like, hi, I'm a duck captain. I mean, what do? What's a duck captain personality like? And so whenever I would get tired, I'd just lay on the floor and put my arms and legs up and play dead duck. And I was like, oh, I can't believe I'm doing this. So then I hear the vice principal say, okay, students, we're going to have the mascots come around and shake people's hands. But I was not sent there with a handler because since they had me salaried and they didn't have to pay me hourly or in bacon anymore to do this duck gig, they didn't pay anybody to be my handler either. So there I was all alone, just this little fox who's like supposed to have my back, you know. We start shaking the hands of the little kids. Now the little kids, you know, they think that you're a real duck, so you have to like not sort of break the like wall between you. And then when they're really cute and they're like, oh, giant duck captain, you know, they're getting kind of excited. And as we get to like the older kids, they're lined up by age, I can tell the kids are getting like, we're gonna get her. Like, that's not a duck. And so I can start to feel them pulling on my costume, you know, and I like, first, it starts with the big duck butt, and I feel people smacking it. And then I feel people grabbing at the arms, and I feel them grabbing at the mitts. And before I know it, I'm swarmed with middle schoolers, and they're banging the big duck head, and it's just chaos. And they're grabbing at my outfit, and they're pulling my little duck mittens, and I'm yelling, like, just swearing like a sailor. And I was like, where is that fox? And I turned around, and what did I see? But a bushy foxtail scampering out the gym. And that's when I decided it was time to quit.
That was Megan Schett. She's one of the funniest people I have ever met. She is reliable for telling very funny stories, both on stage and off. You're listening to a special edition of the Stoop Storytelling Series on WYPR. I'm Jessica Hankin. We need to take a short break, and when we return...
At 15 years old and 10 months, I went and got a job at the only place that would take me seriously. Taco Bell.
Welcome back to a special edition of the Stoop Storytelling Series on WYPR. I'm Laura Wexler.
And I'm Jessica Hankin. Our theme today is work, life, no balance.
We began this hour with stories from teachers. Here's a story about learning an important lesson. Take a listen to storyteller Temi Oni.
When I was a child, I always knew that I wanted to do three things. I wanted to write music, make movies, and design clothes. Now, as the daughter of African immigrants, you can imagine how excited they were when I came to them with this proposal. Ironically, creativity is in my DNA. When I was 5 years old, my father moved back to Nigeria to pursue his dreams of becoming an architect, leaving me and my mom in the U.S. My mom also was an entrepreneur, and she has lived many lives in this space. Now, saying this growing up, I definitely thought I had a great case as to why I should be able to pursue a creative life, doing things the way that I chose. And so I went to my mom and told her that I wanted to be an artist, and she simply told me that it was not possible because they don't make any money. I later found out she was right, but that's besides the point. And so, destined and determined to do things on my own and to prove to my mom that I could do the same things that she could, at 15 years old and 10 months, I went and got a job at the only place that would take me seriously, Taco Bell. After school in the 10th grade, I would work the night shift from 7 to 10 p.m., and I really liked the fact that I was earning a little bit of money. And so the next year, I got my second job and decided that I would double between the two, working at Sears Outlet, where I would sell refurbished refrigerators, washers and dryers, and microwaves to anybody who would buy them for a little bit of commission. I had my first car note when I was 16 years old, and I thought that I was really, really getting an opportunity to become a new adult so that I could move into this creative life. But what I didn't realize is that I was probably doing things that I shouldn't have been. I really wanted to prove to my mom that I could do things on my own, and so when it was time for me to go to college, I couldn't wait to apply to FIT or Pratt or Berkeley, but my mom reminded me that if I really wanted to live a life where I was going to make something of myself, I had to actually pursue STEM. So when I started college, I started as a chemical engineering major, and I can tell you that me and science had anything but chemistry. It's not my vibe, as you can tell. I changed my major 3 times, and finally, just to graduate, I picked psychology. To further spite my parents, when I graduated, I decided that I was going to move to a city that would allow me to pursue my dreams as an artist, where I was guaranteed to make 0 money. New York. At 21 years old, I moved to New York with $600, and I got my first job in the meatpacking district, working as a barista serving beer to people in a beer garden who also hated their jobs. My plan was very simple. I was going to make it as a starving artist, and I was going to blow up and be the biggest person you'd ever seen on any billboards. And so alongside a sound engineer, I'd come up with a plan. I made a friend with a guy who worked at a really big studio. He also wanted to be a producer. And so we made a plan that after I got off of work, we would work in the studio when everyone was gone, and we would write songs together and pitch them to big artists. The only problem is that I got off of work at 3 o'clock in the morning. And so when I would get off work at 3 a.m., I would make my way uptown, and we would work in the studio from 3 a.m. until 7 o'clock in the morning. We had to be out before 9 a.m. when the real session started, and we did this every single day for a year. Yeah. In true New York fashion, I got attacked on the train by a crazy homeless person, and I decided that I was no longer going to risk my life trying to work late at night. And after talking to a friend, they suggested that I try to get a job in a space that still allowed me to be creative but probably gave me better hours and health insurance. So after taking that advice, I did some research and found out about this space called advertising, which I had never heard of. Now, ironically, I had over 6 years of sales experience at 22, but I had never realized that there was a world around us that literally was driven by ads. Everywhere you go, whether it's on TV, on a billboard, in a magazine, there's an advertisement right in front of you, and someone was making it. So I took a job as an executive assistant where I would be assisting 7 creative directors and 1 general manager for the beautiful price of $38,000 a year, where my job was to get coffee, manage schedules, and do expenses, and even almost going to Paris. This is a true story. The pay was terrible, but the experience was invaluable. I got to see how some of the biggest campaigns in the world were created, and I decided to add to my long list of things that I wanted to do, that I wanted to be a creative director. And so I worked my way up, building my portfolio, and I made a deal with this agency that if I kept working there under these conditions, they had to let me build my book. So I worked there for 2 years, I learned everything I needed to learn from them, and then I quit. I got a real job in advertising, and simultaneously, I was still recording and writing songs for independent artists before I decided that I would soon put out my own music. Eventually, 10 plus years, I finally actually did become a creative director, and I realized that there are different ways that I can still trivialize my parents as to what I'm doing with my life. They had no idea what exactly a creative director or anyone in advertising did, but at least I was making a little bit of money. I realized also that in this path, I could still be creative and still be successful doing all the things that I wanted to do. I was still putting out music. I was writing scripts. But there were still different ways in which I felt like I wasn't meeting up with my peers because I hadn't done it the way in which I had set out from the beginning. Funny enough, a lot of people in music actually don't make money, which is why you see Snoop Dogg in commercials every other day. Because the music industry is constantly changing and it's requiring artists to find creative ways to make money outside of their music. You'll see artists getting brand campaigns, always looking for ways in which they can have creative partnerships. And now I am actually the person creating it, saying who I want to be in these commercials. I had one more thing that I wanted to do. I said I wanted to make music, I wanted to write scripts, and I wanted to create fashion. And so the easiest way to do that is that I got pregnant. there are some things that happen in between that, but for the sake of time, just go with me. And I ended up realizing that there was nothing to wear that's for the cool moms who have things to do. And so I started designing clothes, and I started realizing that my creative path didn't have to be one that was making sense to everyone else as long as it made sense to me. I also realized that if your parents ask you to become a doctor, a lawyer, or an engineer, you don't have to do it, and you can actually be like me. But if you really want to make them happy, you can just marry one.
That was Temi Oni. She actually is now a very accomplished musician. You should check her out on Spotify. She's super talented.
We hope to see you at one of our shows this month. On September 21st and 22nd, The Stoop will present Keepers of Culture, Stories About People Who Inspire and Enlighten at the Maryland Folk Festival in Salisbury.
Then on September 27th, we'll share Neighbors, Stories of Friends, Foes, and the Fences in Between at the Green Room in Baltimore. Ticket info is available at stoopstorytelling.com.
Thanks to our producer, Maureen Harvey, and to you for listening. You can hear more from the Stoop Storytelling Series at our website or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Jessica Hinken.
And I'm Laura Wexler. Everyone has a story. What's yours?
Support comes from Catholic Charities. Driven by the message of love your neighbor, Catholic Charities is focused on improving lives in Maryland. Give the gift of love during this holiday season and learn more at cc-md.org/love.